I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Hello, everyone. How are we this evening? Oh, come on. I know it's late, but you've got to give me something here. My name is Rae Johnston, and I will be your host for this evening's session where we get to learn about the horrifying, beautiful, wonderful, terrifying reality of big tech. I'm so sorry. It's probably going to be a bit of a bummer, but we all knew that already, right? A little bit about me. I'm a STEM journalist for TV, radio, online, podcasts. I was the first science and technology editor over at NITV at SBS, and I'm a producer and host of a couple of tech and science-focused podcasts as well, including Queens of the Drone Age, Take It Black, and Here and Beyond, which focuses on Indigenous science. And the world's first technologists are the sovereign First Nations peoples of this very continent, keeping that knowledge and passing it down since time began, despite all attempts to erase it. And as a Wiradjuri woman who was born and raised on Darug and Gundagara country, it is my great honour to be here with you today on the unceded land of the Gadigal, and I pay my deepest respects to Gadigal elders, past and present, and I extend that respect to any of my First Nations aunties and uncles, brothers and sisters who might have decided to come along and join us tonight. Welcome. Now, big tech and its impacts, it's a huge topic, so we're hoping to cover both the basics and the most important issues that we're facing today and into the future in a very short period of time. That being said, there will be plenty of time for questions. Let me introduce you to our panellists for this evening. I have here Angharad Radio. She's an award-winning television presenter, video game critic, technology journalist.
You're allowed to clap for me more, it's okay. Yes!
Rad's one of the hosts of ABC's Good Game Spawn Point. She's also one of my fellow queens on the Queens of the Drone Age podcast and can also be found hosting ABC Science's Elevator Pitch and Rad Experiments and ABC Listen's How Games Play Us. Welcome, Rad. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And then we have over here, Chris Cooper, who is the Executive Director of Reset Australia. Now, Reset Australia is a think tank and advocacy organisation working to counter digital threats to democracy. So just a tiny little thing there. Specifically, the harms of unregulated big tech. He's trained as a cultural anthropologist and has worked at the intersection of strategic communications and advocacy and creative production to leverage culture and storytelling to shape policy, behaviour and systems. Chris is also campaigns director at the Global Social Impact Agency, Purpose, and I look forward to picking his brain. Thank you for joining us, Chris. Next to Chris, we have Ariel Bogle. Ariel is an analyst with ASPI's International Cyber Policy Centre, where she researches online influence and disinformation campaigns, among other topics. And most recently, she was a technology reporter with the ABC. She's won so many awards for her work, including a 2020 Radio National series on health misinformation. She was also technology editor at The Conversation and associate editor with Future Tense, a partnership of Slate, New America, and Arizona State University. Her reporting's been published in the New York Times, The Guardian, The Atlantic, and Slate. We're very lucky to have her here tonight. Thank you, Ariel. Next up, we have Paul Smith. Now, Paul edits the technology section for the Australian Financial Review and has been a leading writer on the sector for almost 20 years now. So you've been there from the beginning, Paul. He covers big tech, how businesses are using technology, fast-growing startups, telecommunications, and national innovation policy. So as you can see, we've got quite a large variety of expertise here on the panel. So get those questions thinking. I'm going to start at the beginning, though. When we say big tech, who are we talking about exactly, Rad?
Well, when a small tech eats all of its crusts and oatmeal... and grows nice and big and strong, it becomes big tech. No, so when we talk big tech, we're really looking at the big companies in technology. So your Apples, your Google, your Microsoft, your Facebook, and that really extends in this day and age to social media as well. Those are some of the biggest companies in the technology sector. And even though we call them social media, they don't fall under like the media banner when it comes to regulation and things like that. They're considered technology companies. So it's kind of the same as like Uber. When you think about Uber, you're like, oh, they're a transport company, but they're actually considered a technology company. So I think those are the names. Did I miss anyone?
Amazon.
Amazon's what I missed. I was like, I'm surely I've missed one. Amazon's a big one. Yeah, Amazon.
So what does big tech want, Paul?
Well, depends who you're asking. I mean, I think the company that springs largest into my mind when we're talking about big tech and the influence is Facebook, because that has been the real window through which a lot of people have experienced life for the last 10, well, 15, when did Facebook start?
I joined in 2008.
Yeah, but it's, you can see, well, Mark Zuckerberg started the company because he wanted to get back at girls that wouldn't go out with him. That was the foundation of Facebook. But you would say that the grand highfalutin ideals is connecting the world, making life easier, opening communications up. But in reality, it's panned out over the journey to be a lot more of a commercial operation, a lot more sinister in many ways than people like to talk about or like to imagine when they're talking about the financials of an organization, for example.
Can we just say making money? I mean, they're all companies. Like, that's what they want to do. They want to make money.
They do, but how much do you need? That's the thing.
More. And in fact, today was, this week was the quarterly earnings for companies like Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and they all posted record profits. While everybody else was sort of doing the damage of the pandemic, it turned out pretty well for them.
And they're putting that money to good use, I suppose.
You are actually, Ariel, because I made a few notes. Because I wanted to try and look clever. In the last, they did the first quarter of this year, Facebook earned revenue of $26.2 billion, and they had up to 2.85 billion monthly active users, wow, which is an increase of 10%. So people talk about Facebook as it's on the decline, it's older people now, but still growing 10% in a quarter.
Yeah, absolutely.
2.85 billion active users.
So what sort of impact is big tech having on our lives? I know it's a huge question, but what stands out to you, Chris?
Well, I think that something that's important is that one thing that big tech companies hate is being called big tech and lumped in together, because they are different, right? Like Apple has a different value to society and a different impact versus Facebook. And if I was Apple, I would fucking hate to be lumped in with Facebook. I mean, the work that we do focuses a lot on social media and the impact that they have on society, which is, for them, wrapped in this nice bubble of connecting communities and giving people a voice. And certainly it does that at some level, but the harms that they cause far outweigh those benefits. And for us, that's really about like the extractive data practices that these companies are built on. And this is also why they're big. They have the raw materials that turned them into mega companies is your data, and they never had to pay for that, and they've never had to. So that's why they're big, and there's a whole bunch of impacts that come from that, which I would argue is, on balance, is becoming more negative than positive.
What kind of impact is it having on us as people, as individuals, as communities that interact with other communities, Ariel?
Yeah, once again, a huge question. I guess I'll try and put it within the realm of what I was doing last year when I was at the ABC, was mainly reporting on disinformation related to COVID-19, related to vaccines, a lot around conspiracy theories. A lot of people in the room have probably heard of QAnon by this point, these kinds of folk tales, I suppose, that sort of evolve into becoming a force that can motivate people to storm the White House, as happened, or attempted storming of Capitol Hill, rather, on January 6th. So it's not that misinformation never existed before, or that conspiracy theories never existed before, or indeed that conspiracies don't actually happen. There are real conspiracies. It's more that these platforms were amplifying these kinds of messages, spreading them faster than they've ever been spread before, and also allowing an element of connectivity. So at the beginning of the pandemic, I think I wrote my first story about like COVID conspiracy theories. It was the one, you know, the Bill Gates created COVID one, which like everybody and your aunts shared. That was back in January, but you could see these groups forming on Facebook, and they would be like COVID discussion Facebook group where people were just sort of sharing information about COVID, because of course it's a very scary time, a global pandemic. You want information, people want to share the best information available. But I watched those groups grow, sort of metastasize and become conspiratorial, and Facebook's recommendation algorithm allowed those kind of groups, once you join them, they'd recommend other groups to join, which would be sort of take people on that journey further and further into conspiratorial communities. So it's what I guess that's one of the impacts. It's this kind of the connectivity that can create a social movement or connect friends can also connect people into a kind of I would feel like a sort of fearful state of mind. Like I felt when people were telling me about their experiences of COVID and disinformation that they were really distressed that their friends and family were kind of taking these paths, that what was true about COVID and what wasn't true could no longer be agreed on between friends and family. And social media, we can debate whether it caused that, but it certainly played a role in that.
It's made us all a bit weird, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, it comes to the complete lack of responsibility that the platforms themselves have over the power that they've created for themselves. I work for Nine, obviously a big media company, and so would necessarily come from the point of view of having some editorial oversight. But if you go back, say, 10, 15 years, Mark Zuckerberg was Time Magazine's Man of the Year, and people were talking about how Twitter had helped in the Arab Spring, and it was a very positive idea of communities getting together where they couldn't talk before, and it's kind of been lost. Obviously, it's been lost with too many scandals and companies growing too big. And the whole problem, I think, that Ariel's just talking about comes from a lack of responsibility and a lack of need for the platforms to actually change what's happening. They make a huge amount of money all over the world, not just in America, not just in Australia, but in all parts of the world where they are literally not policing the content at all, taking all the money for it and none of the responsibility. Regimes have been changed because of blatantly false media reporting that's gone on there that anyone could fact check, but they're just not. They're asleep. No one's asleep at the wheel. No one's at the wheel, because you physically cannot have a business as profitable as Facebook and have proper editorial control. So you either limit what you can do on these platforms and remove what makes them so special, or you accept that you're going to have platforms that facilitate genocide, facilitate misinformation, and unjust regime change.
But see, I almost think that makes it sound like they can't be doing more.
They should be.
They absolutely
should be. That's a choice they have
be.
To make. But sorry to add a bit
no, yeah.
But they make it. I mean, I read out the profit numbers there. You would say, for example, you can live stream on Facebook. How can anyone police that? Well, shit, of course you can't, because it's people all over the world posting. How can you moderate that in any reasonable length of time? But that is the business model from which they have created this vast fortune, but haven't had to take the responsibility for it. A ludicrous situation we found ourselves in at Nine, we used to be Fairfax, was comments on Facebook articles that we couldn't moderate beforehand. They've changed that now. We got sued for comments on an article that were defamatory. They were defamatory. We got sued. Facebook were completely scot-free. So and we had no ability to moderate them before they were put up.
Yeah, and they shirk responsibility while, like, part of the issue there is the scale and the speed at which things travel, right? So their interest is in taking what's engaging and amplifying it, and like artificially amplifying it to as many people as possible. And the metric that they use for that is attention and your engagement. So that's going to be the more sensational, the more outrageous, the more conspiratorial, because we're human and that's more interesting. And so their whole business model is predicated on grabbing those kind of comments, amplifying them, taking no responsibility for that, but also profiting from that. But I think the other really important point that Ariel was making was really looking at the way that a democracy normally functions is that we have, you know, and this isn't perfect, but we have a public square where we have a shared set of facts that we debate around, and that debate is the process of democracy. But what these platforms do is they push people into echo chambers where they're feeding them the same thing and the same worldview and the same ideology over and over again, so it's reinforcing. And so you get to a point where people are storming the Capitol building in Washington who, if you take a kind view to those people, are acting pretty rationally, because everything that they were seeing was that your election was stolen. If our election was stolen, we should storm Parliament House. Like, that's a rational and a reasonable thing to do. The problem is that it's completely false, but there's just no checks and balances there. And particularly for America, you've now got different public squares where people are operating with a different set of facts at the base of that. And that is like a core threat to democracy.
I'm going to jump in there too, because I don't want to take responsibility away from Facebook, but the way it influences the media too, because a lot of people in the United States were hearing that their election was stolen, not just from their friends on Facebook, but from Fox News, from outlets like the New York Post. Like, it was a media ecosystem which sort of has a sort of symbiotic relationship with Facebook now, where it relies on traffic from those sites, you know, outlets like Fox News, OAN, and even our own homegrown Sky News really do very well on places like YouTube now as well. So there's kind of like, we're sort of competing to outdo each other at the worst of what we could possibly do. And I'd also make the point too is that we still kind of don't know what we don't know, because the other issue here with these major platforms is transparency. So we're scrapping around the edges when we try to study Facebook and how information spreads on Facebook. Same with YouTube. I would say YouTube is probably one of the least transparent platforms. Very difficult from my perspective as somebody that researches disinformation to understand what in the world is going on there. The kind of stats they release, where they do release stats, say that they received 20 inquiries from police in Australia for information and they handed over in 10 cases. That kind of transparency, but not transparency about which specific content they removed, who they've banned, when there have been false positives and they've taken down content that should have been taken down. I mean, these kinds of stats would help us understand and give us a better picture of what's going on, but we don't know, and so we can't. I would just like emphasize that sometimes when we talk about disinformation and how content spreads, we're sort of guessing, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that's right. We see the social impacts, whether it's a genocide or increases in anxiety and suicide in young people or polarization, and we try to reverse engineer where that problem's come from, and we back into these opaque companies where we have no insight really, no meaningful insight into how they're amplifying. But I think the point you're making also is really important, which is that it's not that they create these problems, they just inflame them and turn them from problems that existed into like massive issues.
At the risk of sounding too sympathetic to these companies, do you think it's also an issue where they feel that if they step in, if they start to do more, then they have to do everything? They'll be expected to really, you know, police on a much higher level if they start doing the little that they can do?
Well, there's definitely the sense, whenever you talk about any sort of regulation of the platforms, of global precedence. I mean, there was obviously a huge amount of fuss in Australia in recent times about the ACCC media bargaining code, when media companies were going to extract some payments from Google and Facebook for news articles, about not giving an inch, because everything, their global operations, and they'd much rather suffer in one small market than have something go globally. And the example I used when I was writing about it, I have a big Scandinavia file of all the Nordic noir dramas, and so I used the excuse to look around there. I called up some people in Denmark, because in Denmark, some of the music industry had been arguing with Google about paying for Danish rights for Danish music on YouTube, and they had a deal in place, and they weren't happy with it, and they were renegotiating. And Google came back and said, "We'll offer you half what you're getting now." And obviously, they were already unhappy with the deal, but Google was concurrently negotiating with the whole of the European Union and didn't want to set a precedent. And so when Denmark said, "Well, we're not happy with that," they just pressed a button, and you could no longer get Danish music on YouTube. And so it was a precursor to how the negotiations went in Australia, both with Facebook and Google, when they were talking about paying for news. Well, we might just have to switch news off, because they're more than willing to do that. So it actually needs a concerted global effort to regulate, and that's just not going to happen.
It's funny, isn't it? Because that moment when, you know, all of those news sites got taken down and everything else. Does everyone know about this? I assume it happened to all of us. We all saw it, yeah? Some nods, yeah. when all of the news sites got taken off Facebook.
The news sites, all the emergency services sites, all of the things that we didn't know that we needed on Facebook.
Bunch of small businesses.
Gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It felt like the moment that I had been waiting for, where everyone would go, "Oh, shit, these companies really do control such a large portion of our lives and how we connect to everything, and we don't know how to function anymore without them." But then the government did strike a deal, everything came back up, and we all just went, "Ah," yeah. And that was it.
Yeah, it does feel, I mean...
anticlimactic.
Yeah, there was no good guys in that argument, was there? Because as soon as you started talking about extracting payments, people were talking about this came from News Limited. We're just taking money off one company and giving it to another. But I think the actual point of it was much more important than that. It was actually some accountability for what's been taken for a long time for free and profited from, and just putting some value on news content in this sense. But you'd have, in other sense, music and others, actually making these platforms put a value on the assets that they have taken to build their audience. And I think it was lost a little bit. And in my opinion, Google and Facebook won that argument. The government came out and had their Australia has been refriended and got their photo opportunity. But Google and Facebook essentially got what they wanted. Deals are still done on their platform. In 4 years, when people are renegotiating, a different bunch of politicians will be there, and they won't have the stomach for the same fight. So we've just, yeah.
Google's solution was a Google product,
yeah,
ultimately. And also, the richest companies in the world just bought their way out from under regulation. But if you compare those deals to the deal that was struck in France just before it landed here, which was a 30 million euro deal for all of the French publishers, and they went a very different way to extracting that. That was for all 150 French publishers or whatever. Yeah. And Seven West here got 30 million a year just to them. So, like, you know, it was effective in terms of getting the best deals that any publishers in the world have gotten. And I think what is most important about it is that there's a bunch of other countries we know. The UK are very close to it. Canada is very close to doing exactly the same sort of thing. And they'll build on that and, you know, make it better, make it so that that money that's extracted actually goes to journalism. I think that's one of the biggest flaws in the code, right, is that we don't know where that money goes that goes to any of the publishers. Does it go to the salaries of journalists, or does it go to bonuses, right? That's
salaries of journalists. Well,
it's actually interesting, because we were just talking backstage, Rad and Ray have got a podcast that's fairly recently started. So you would fall under the category of smaller publishers. Would likely get nothing from a deal like this. But then you would also have the opposite side, being very negative about it, of using these platforms to promote. So I don't know, I don't know whether you would feel that you got shortchanged by something like a deal like this, or...
Honestly, personally, it didn't really impact in any way, because we're brand new and very small, but I can understand how it would have. And it did have a significant impact on a lot of, you know, independent publishers as well. You know, people that don't have the backings of the big media companies. You know, a lot of community sites, you know, in gaming, for example, were hit really hard.
I think it's even just scary. It's even just scary knowing that what you feel like is the tap is going to be turned off and you can't do anything about it. And so, yeah, it's easy to be really staunch in saying that something needs to change and they need to pay us when you are getting that traffic, but when that gets turned off, all of a sudden you just go into survival mode, I think.
Yeah, I mean, sorry to cut in there, but we were really receiving a lot of feedback when we were writing articles about the media bargaining code, that people weren't on the side of media. There was a lot of small businesses, for example, saying we rely on Google, and Google were putting all these threats out there that your Google search is under threat. And to me, and obviously I had a horse in the race working for a big media organization, but there was a real sense of Stockholm syndrome. We need this platform to find our customers. We're willing to pay, you know, a huge proportion of what we earn from them back to them to be visible there. And please don't do anything to make them turn it off.
Well, yeah, it's a matter of what's important to you as well. You know, if people finding your business on Google is going to be more important to you than accessing articles on Facebook, then so be it. And for most people, it is.
It might be like the love of chaos in me a little bit, but I kind of wanted to see what would happen.
No.
I just kind of want to know.
Speaking of chaos, privacy. I want to change tact a little here. We all know that our privacy has been completely eroded by big tech. How bad is it, though? Is there any going back from where we are? Can you really just back away from it all and nope out of big tech knowing your every move?
No, I don't think you can at all. I think it's far too profitable for these companies to know everything about you. That is their business model, essentially. And I think that we've built a society within which it's impossible to opt out. Like, you can't do anything without being connected to at least one of these systems. And they've won because they've created something incredibly convenient. And humans love convenience. We froth it. It's so good. We would rather, like, pay a little bit more for a drink that we can get right in front of us than walk a kilometer to get it for free. Yeah. You know, we just love it so much. So I think that unless there is major intervention, and that's why legislation is so important, we're just going to continue doing the same thing, being like, oh, this isn't great, is it? This is a bit bad.
Yeah, just to jump, like, to, I mean, it's a writer's festival, we get a little philosophical for just a moment. Like, the metaphor is always like the panopticon, right? This idea of like society of discipline where there's a central sort of watchtower in the middle of a factory, and it's not that you're necessarily being watched all the time, it's that you feel like you may be being watched, and that's what imposes like discipline and behaving as society dictates you ought to. So I think like the panopticon's no longer really a useful metaphor in my view. It's more like this idea of permanent surveillance. It's not like, and that feels like freedom, actually. That's what's so weird about it. That's where the convenience comes in. We feel free at the moment, you know, especially after the pandemic, to maybe work from home. You're a little more flexible, but then you see that the technology letting work and your personal life sort of bleed into each other more and more. So this permanent state of surveillance is what is doing privacy in, essentially, but it kind of feels good, and that's what's so insidious about it. But just to look at the legislative side of it, as was being, you know, flagged, I think it's important to look at Australia's shortcomings. The Privacy Act in Australia is like a real mess, in my personal opinion. If there's any lawyers out there, you could feel free to disagree with me. But there's actually like a review of the Privacy Act going on under the Attorney General's department. It was sort of flagged by the same ACCC inquiry that we were just talking about, which was looking at the power of these big platforms. But the government and the political parties in general have not been very good at taking privacy law, modifying it, and making it fit for purpose for how we live now. And they're especially unwilling to give up their own exemptions. So I don't know, it's not very well known, but political parties are in fact exempt from the Privacy Act, which means every time the election comes around, they're data mining all of us like there's no tomorrow, collecting it, putting it together with social media profiles, putting trackers in your emails so they know when they're opened or not, where they've been opened, using all kinds of technology. So I feel like we're asking both the perpetrator of some invasions of privacy to try and regulate us at the same time.
So I say that we need legislation, but I have no idea what that would actually look like. I still am just like, how, what would you, what would you
put? We've actually got into the strange situation at the moment where Apple are suddenly the privacy good guys, because in the next version of iOS, I can't remember what number we're up to, they're going to enforce a rule where you have to, if you're profiting or on selling or using the data, you have to actually let them know about it. And it's turned into an argument between Facebook and Apple. I mentioned earlier that Facebook had their results earlier, and Facebook, I wrote the quote down here because they just rank insincerity. This is Facebook's chief financial officer talking about why he's worried about Apple stopping people from just selling the data. We continue to be concerned about the impact this update is going to have on the ability of small businesses to use their advertising budgets effectively. I mean, come on.
Protecting a small
Thank
business.
You.
Good yeah. guy, Facebook.
Yeah. I mean,
I think we've kind of sleptwalked into this, because you're right, like we love the convenience, but we've also just come to this, we've kind of walked into this relationship where we think that this is the way that the internet has to be, and I think that's bullshit. I think that there's plenty of ways that we can...
Paint me a picture of another world.
Yeah.
Well, so I think that it's, because it's so big and complex, you need to look at how, like, where to start. This is going to be a multi-step process, and like, I think a really important place to start in terms of the privacy problems is with young people, to say that, like, are we we might be okay with, like, Facebook tracking every bit of what we do across the internet, even off the platform, but, like, are we actually comfortable with these companies surveilling and tracking and collecting data on young people and then building profiles that they then use to sell to advertisers? Like, that's 13-year-olds and younger, all those kids who, you know, outsmart that amazing hurdle and say they're 13. Like, are we okay with that? Because I don't think we are. And I think that there's already legislation that's happening in other countries. The UK have already legislated this. Ireland's looking at the same thing. We're now pushing for the same thing here, which is just to say that, look, if people are under 18 and you're a digital service or digital platform, you shouldn't be able to track, surveil, and collect data on young people unless it's in their interest. And in no way is advertising ever going to pass that test.
See, I hear from people all the time that say, I don't care if I'm being tracked, I don't care if my data's being collected, I've got nothing to hide, I'm not doing anything wrong, you know, what is the big deal? So what is the big deal?
So, okay, so yesterday, good question. Yesterday we released a report that showed what you can do with this data, which is, we essentially ran an experiment where we created a fake advertising account on Facebook, and we wanted to see what kind of profiling can we do of teenagers. And we didn't publish any ads, I should say that first, but we went on the ad platform and we were able to target 13-year-old girls interested in online dating services. We were able to target 13 to 17-year-olds interested in extreme weight loss, in gambling, alcohol, smoking. And this is all...
Why is extreme weight loss even on there?
Exactly, right? But to make it worse, we didn't just show that you can access and buy access to those profiles. We created ads that were completely fucking inappropriate for young people. And this is things like, images of women in bikinis saying, are you summer ready? And then targeting that to 13-year-olds interested in extreme weight loss. And we uploaded that to see if Facebook would approve that. And they approved every single one of these ads, except for three, actually. The two that they rejected were the ones that had cigarettes in the images, which means that two things. One is that all of their checks and balances are perfectly in place and working, but that B, that this is available to any advertiser, and an advertiser on Facebook is anyone with a credit card. And so we should have a serious conversation as a society whether we're comfortable with that. And we should turn the tap off and say that entire business model is fueled by the collection of young people's data. I think we should turn that off.
Did I dream it, or were they talking about Instagram for kids?
Yes,
recently
Instagram
as well?
For kids.
Yeah, the same
fun
people.
Times.
Yeah.
See, it always fascinates me, you know, the amount of data that is being collected about us, you know, how we can't really fathom that. And even the companies that we interact with that we don't even realise are collecting data on us or use that as the core part of their business. I'll never forget a conversation that I had with Fitbit. You know, you think of Fitbit, you think fitness bands, they're going to remind me to take my 10,000 steps. And they literally said to me, we are a data company. Our main business is collecting data from all that information. They've got Fitbits for kids now. They're collecting all that information. But there is a, oh, I'm going to say something terrible. There's a good side to that. And that is that Fitbit now holds the world's only database on what a healthy woman looks like. Because up until the 90s, no medical experiments, studies, medical studies were carried out on women. They were just seen as an abnormality of the male body. So we don't have big data sets on what healthy women look like because we're only collecting data on what unhealthy women look like when they're presenting to medical professionals.
Well, that's the thing, right?
Tech is cool.
Tech is really cool. It's got so much great stuff in it. The problem is when it's under the control of people that just have their business interests at heart and yep. there are no checks in place. Because it's that thing of like, if you're focused on growing your business, you're going to start to do nasty things because it works, unfortunately. And to look at these companies and say, now you have to grow a conscience, you have to be moral, and you have to do it of your own accord, it's just not going to... It's like telling the naughty kid in school to be good now. Like, it's just not going to happen.
This is exactly it. Like, using big data is a good thing. Like, there's a ton of potential there, and we don't want to turn that off. But we need to have a more nuanced conversation around whose data, how it's collected, consent. Let's have a deep conversation about that. And then also like how it's used, like it matters, right? Facebook is an advertising company. Fitbit, like, I mean, are they using it for the public good? Is it in the public interest?
They say
like,
they are, but who are they going to sell it to next?
Right,
we don't know. We don't know where that data's going to go.
I mean, surely they're selling it to advertisers to target those people who are trying to get fit and healthy. And that could be anyone. That could be Hungry Jack's and McDonald's who want to target those people and know that they're vulnerable and trying to work their way out of it. I mean, like, there's just no checks and balances. But and this is why the legislation side of it is so difficult, because we want tech. We want our tech products. But we want them to work for us and not against us. And we want some checks and balances.
And we've got a government who, you know, can't build a census website that doesn't crash. So
I might be wrong too, but isn't Apple trying to buy Fitbit?
Yeah.
So the other issue here is like the endless consolidation. I mean, just not to return to the antitrust issue once again, but it's sheer scale. It's not like Facebook grew from nothing to what it is today. It acquired a multitude of companies. Google is the same. It, in fact, purchased its ad property, which is like the key source of its eye-watering revenues today. So that's the other issue, is our laws around antitrust and monopoly are sort of out of date. I think this is kind of more of an American understanding of antitrust law, but in general, the test is like, what's the impact on the consumer? And the impact is great because most of this stuff's free. And a Fitbit is not that expensive. I mean, iPhone is on the other side. It's pretty expensive. But, you know, using Facebook's free, Google search is free. You can use Spotify for free and to pay for it, you know, these different levels. And the sort of push from some critics and advocates and academics is to start looking at market power. We can no longer understand these companies and their impact on us through price because they're cheap to us. We've got to start looking at power, and I think that's what we're really talking about at the end of the day, is the outsized power these companies have been managed to accumulate and wield.
Yeah, I wanted to just bring back to what Ray was saying before about this idea of just this map that people can have of everyone,
yeah.
and the idea of, oh, I'm doing nothing wrong, I've got nothing to hide. And I first really started thinking about this when we were talking about the facial recognition database that the government was pulling together nominally.
They're still trying to.
Yeah, nominally to protect us from terrorism and things like that, but also brings all kinds of questions into people knowing what you're doing at any time of the day. And this idea of, I'm not doing anything wrong, but it's actually, not saying I want to, but it's not illegal to do the wrong thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it is my right to go away from here and do the wrong thing without someone being able to say to me, don't write that story, because do you want your wife to know where you went after you were at the Writers' Festival? because that's the possibility that we raise from this kind of...
It's kind of like it's not wrong to fart, but you don't want people to know about it.
I think there's also an assumption there that comes with, you know, when you're allowing authorities and people that have literal power over your life to surveil and control you in this way, there comes with an assumption that they're not going to do anything wrong with that, and history will tell us that that is absolutely not the case.
You may not like the current government or the one beforehand, but we live in a relatively benevolent society, but you shouldn't labour under the pretense that it's always going to be that way. It's not too far from the realms of possibilities that we will one day have a more authoritarian regime who has seen everywhere you've been for the last 40 years, who you've hung around with when you went and consorted with other people. And we should push back against people knowing too much that they don't need to know, because they don't need to know that I might go and have a drink with someone after. Yeah.
I do want to know, is there any way that big tech could be a positive influence on the future? We've talked about the negative influence. Is there a way that it could be a good thing?
Can I jump in first?
Yeah.
What we were saying before, there's huge potential in big data. I mean, there's a guy I really like that's based in Sydney that was in charge of massive AI projects at Google, and huge amounts of things are spotting skin cancers and spotting different types of fish in the sea from satellites, and so you can do conservation. There's huge potential for it, but it's just discussions like this are happening because everyone's becoming much more aware of the negative aspects of it. So, yeah, obviously, I mean, we want to find, you know, cures for diseases and things like that, and have happier discussions and stay in touch with people around the world. We just don't want all the shit that goes with it.
Fair enough. We do have questions. Let's throw to them. We'll go over here.
Thanks for the great panel, guys. I'm just wondering if there's any data around the effectiveness of GDPR-style data laws or California-style data laws, and whether they'd be implemented potentially in Australia with a privacy review. And just on that, what are big tech doing to get around these laws?
So the GDPR is is the European Union's new general data privacy regulation. Yes, which was sort of considered a pretty path-breaking kind of new idea of privacy. I think you probably all actually have experienced it. When you go to websites now, there's often a pop-up that asks if you want to manage your privacy settings or accept all. And that's a product of the GDPR, because it tried to sort of break down what kind of data collection people were consenting to when they were interacting with tech platforms. It's an interesting model to consider. I bet lots of people in the room just press accept all, because we want to get faster to the content we want. shows one of the issues with GDPR is that this idea of active consent, informed consent, is maybe no longer useful when you have to consent to so many different things every day with the kind of data that's collected about you. I love the idea of informed consent and knowing where everything I have goes, but like, I visit innumerable websites a day, and the idea of me truly understanding where my data goes and what I'm consenting to at each sort of stop is impossible. So that's one issue with the GDPR, but certainly I'm sure as the Privacy Act debate continues here in Australia, we'll see if what kind of influence that law has had here.
Yeah, and you asked about... she's gone, sorry. You asked about what companies are doing to get around it, and anything they can to hide what they're really collecting. We just had the case in Australia where Google got caught for hiding in Android phones. If you don't want to be tracked, my location tracked, click no. That wasn't enough. You had to click a second one because they hid it behind some other options. So even if you clicked don't track my location, they'd still got permission to track your location. So they hide it, and so that's about informed consent and, yeah.
Question over here.
Hello, everyone. James Murdoch, son of the chairman of News Corp and owner of 70% of our country's print readership, Rupert Murdoch, recently stated in the New York Times that News Corp is in the business of legitimizing disinformation like QAnon, and this can spill into other platforms. With Murdoch's Sky News Australia's YouTube channel growing exponentially and so many online articles having their origins from a Murdoch print story, my question is, How can we deal with this mass disinformation from big media outlets operating under big social media outlets whilst protecting free and open journalism, particularly in a legislative sense?
I mean, we look at these problems through the lens of, like, what's the impact on democracy? And, I mean, the Murdoch press is certainly an issue for for democracy. And so we need to deal with that. But I think an example of this is with the bushfires last year?
Yeah, 2019.
Yeah. But the bushfire, you're talking about the bushfire rumours were January 2020.
Yeah, yeah. And so what we saw there was a Murdoch headline that was irresponsibly written in that it was sensational, saying that arsonists had lit fires, which had some truth into it, but you had to read the whole article to realize that it was irrelevant to the scale of those bushfires or the reason, or, you know, or the fact that climate change was the key driver in them. But that headline itself was picked up, and that became the ammunition and the fuel that ignited a huge misinformation machine, like powered by Facebook largely and Twitter. And so they're absolutely related, and they're both a problem. I think they're just very different. They need very different solutions. Like, we need to talk about media diversity. Like, we clearly have a problem here in Australia, but you're right, they do fuel misinformation on the platforms that then amplify it exponentially, in the same way that individuals can do it too, like Craig Kelly, Donald Trump. Like, they are problems that fuel that fire, but they require different, different approaches. But certainly we need to address both of those if we're going to fix the kind of information ecosystem in which we're supposed to be relying for critical debate.
And you do raise a very good point. In the fact of, and if I can represent traditional media company here, not legitimizing fake news by then reporting it in a legitimate publication that can then be then used illegitimately on social media. We have had in the newsroom I worked with leaks, documents sent to investigative reporters, which purport to be great stories, often the case I'm thinking about from the US against China, for example, that was showing real, but it didn't smell right. And it was stories attempting to be planted by, you'd have to surmise, secret services and to then be reported and legitimized and then be used over in the US. And that's happened with, I can't remember the story, there was a story that was running News Limited here.
Sharon Markson, was that it was the
yes. It's the dossier.
There was the dodgy dossier.
Wuhan lab dossier, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's reported in a legitimate publication in Australia, and then it can get picked up by the shock jocks over in the US and take on a life of its own. So yeah, you're right, there is a huge onus. Well, that's what I was trying to say before about having journalists in there that actually are accountable if they stuff up, and, you know, it's our bylines on it, and actually want to actually tell the news as it's happening rather than be involved in these games. And most journalists, genuinely, I can tell you, are like that. We don't want to be duped and we'll be hugely embarrassed. But it is a huge responsibility to actually verify what you've been leaked, even though it sounds like a great story.
Yeah, there's also an issue of, like, sort of a lot of younger, you know, emerging reporters, younger generations of reporters, and a lot of older reporters are very tech savvy, but, I mean, I know tech editor, very internet savvy tech editor, but in newsrooms, often editors and the people making decisions about what stories ultimately run don't always understand the internet ecosystem. And so we've seen a lot of issues with that, with headlines, especially about, say, the vaccine rollout. All it takes is a headline that says, I'm trying to think if recent. So let's take a COVID one. There was a headline in the New York Post that said vitamin C COVID cure or something like this, you know, vitamin C colon COVID cure. Immediately we could see that headlines, the story's cut away, the story no longer matters, the screenshot of the headline's all that matters, flowing through all these sort of anti-vaccination activist groups. So there's a role here for the media too, to sort of wise up to how your content will be used. But that, you know, that's with the best of intentions, the kind of outlets that are deliberately exploiting sensationalism and disinformation is another problem, maybe a problem for regulation.
Another question over here.
Cool. Cool. Hey, guys. I was keen to get your take on artificial intelligence and algorithms and what kind of policy you'd want to see put in place to help protect us and the language around that as well.
Ooh. Well, the human rights, Australian rights, are doing these reports on ethics at the moment as well. And because there's obviously huge potential for AI to be useful, but also to be misused terribly in things like even hiring in organizations. So look, it's a massive area. There's a really influential guy at one of the local universities that's a global leader also in the area of AI in weaponry. So we don't have killer robots in war. Yeah.
What is it? The Coalition for Against Killer Robots. I get their press releases all the time.
The obvious initial problems are discrimination.
Yep.
Because the systems are learning from what's gone on before, and what's gone on before isn't always right.
Yeah.
I love that we talked a bunch about like security and privacy, and then you've come in, you're like, yeah, but at what point does a robot become a human? Because we need to know.
Yeah.
I like the term though, just to have an excuse to say it, is Potemkin AI. And I think it's coined by an academic at Monash, Jathan Sadowski. He talks about the fact they seem like machines that are operating their own, but they're actually completely the formation of human decisions. That's what Paul's sort of referring to, the kind of data that you might feed into an AI system that decides who gets mortgages, may start discriminating against people from certain suburbs because of historical data about what type of people live in those suburbs, you know. And also, having received a lot of press releases about whizbang AI, I think all the journalists on the panel would have experienced this. At the end of the day, a lot of it doesn't quite say what it says it does and is still really humans behind the scenes choosing the best results to show off to the journalists. So
and I think that's one of the things about AI. It is so human. It's so human on every level. There are humans deciding which data sets to use, you know, that include certain types of humans. You know, there needs to be a huge overhaul of those data sets. That's really where it starts from. And there needs to be a lot more people in the room when that's happening to be able to point out the flaws in that system. And those people in the room need to come from different backgrounds.
And I need to have seen some movies. The number of people that have never watched Terminator 2.
AI is only good if its parents are good.
Oh, man.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. But yeah, great question. Head over here.
Hi, thank you for the panel. As you've all kind of touched on, regulators face a really tough challenge in balancing the public interest in innovation and protecting society from the abuse of market power. In Australia, I think it's fair to say that regulators are trying. They have an increasing focus on regulating platforms, like the bargaining code was world leading. We currently have the online harms bill before the Senate. In trying to resolve that balance, does the panel have an example of overseas regulation that they view in a really positive light that Australian regulators could learn from?
Yes. there's a few, but I think the Digital Services Act, which is an EU piece of proposed legislation, which will get pulled apart and lobbied to its death maybe, but it lays out, I think, the first really progressive piece of regulation around social media and big tech. And what it does a bunch of things, it's big, but one of the key things is what I think a lot of the regulation here fails to do, which is that here it focuses on content, and it's essentially we say there's harmful content and there's malicious actors. So we should stop that content and we should stop those malicious actors, whether they're predators or terrorists or whatever it might be. But that all ignores the systems within which they're operating and are enabled by, and particularly the algorithms, which are both weaponized and have these unintended consequences. The Digital Services Act says there needs to be regulators who have the ability and the authority to audit those algorithms. And that doesn't mean that it's going to like open up Facebook's algorithm and make it public and ruin their, you know, expose their secret source or whatever. It just says that like you're accountable, and we're going to, like we regulate any other industry, whether it's the contents and the ingredients in food or the contents that the quality of the components in a car, you need to be regulated. And we need to know that these algorithms are working in ways that aren't causing harm. And that is a game changer, I think. And so that's like a really shining piece of legislation that I think will be replicated. And sets out a different tone for regulation to come.
Yeah, I haven't seen one in the world, but one law I would like, not very well thought through. I'd like an age limit on when you're allowed to get a phone. I don't think my daughter is at the age where she's about to get her first phone, and I don't want her to get it. And I just don't see. I don't know the arguments about keeping in touch and, you know, arranging when you're going to get picked up. I just don't think kids should have phones until, I don't know, 15, 16? I don't know. I just don't see a value.
Sorry, for how old's your daughter?
She's 11. No, she's 12. 12, just turned 12.
Good luck.
I just
some fun conversations. I've got 19-year-old at home.
I just wish they would just clear off and leave them alone for a bit. Anyway.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for, folks. But please jump on social media, hit us up in any way that you can. We can answer more of your questions afterwards. Thank you so much for coming along and listening to us this evening and for contributing some fantastic questions. Please join me in thanking our panelists for tonight.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.